In other ways, though, agriculture suffered enormously. Sullen peasants generally refused to exert themselves, though could be forced, though the grain could be taken away and other food products, they would work as if under serfdom, as weakly, as poorly as possible. In fact, many peasants themselves began to refer to all this as if it were serfdom returned. And they began to notice that the initials for the All-Russian Communist Party, or then the All-Soviet Communist Party, VKP, were also the initials for the Russian term second serfdom. It seemed to them a symbol of what this was all about. Productivity in agriculture also suffered enormously from this massive slaughter of livestock at the end, in the midst of collectivization. This affected how much fertilizer was available. There was very little manufactured. Most came from animals. The amount of draft power was much reduced. There were very few tractors yet. Therefore, there was very little left to pull the plows. And animal products and dairy products, meat and milk, were much less available now in the cities. From a different and maybe even more important point of view, the most serious consequence of collectivization, though, was its toll on human lives, on peasants themselves. For all peasants, a traditional way of life was suddenly and almost overnight destroyed, not in the gradual way we saw peasant life changing, but dramatically and suddenly. Many peasants, in fact, adding to all of this loss of their of a way of life, also lost their lives. Maybe millions, it's estimated by most historians, died in the process of collectivization. They died when they were arrested as kulaks and sent to the camps. Many died on the way. They died when they were shot, as some groups were, for being enemies of collectivization. And the largest number died during a horrible famine in 1932-33, mostly in Ukraine. And many people believe this famine to have been engineered by the state, that available grain in other parts of the country was deliberately withheld from peasants, where harvests were bad, in order to force them to submit through starvation. Now, it's sometimes hard to remember, when recounting the horrors of these years, that this was also a time of heroic idealism. In many ways, in fact, these two faces were inseparable for understanding this first Stalinist revolution. Irrationality and brutality and suffering, on the one hand, was linked with idealism and optimism and making a sense of making a better world. One sign of this was a pervasive idea at the time that this first five-year plan's revolution was not only an economic revolution, but also a cultural revolution, creating a new society with new values. In the language of the time, this meant asserting a new proletarian culture against the old bourgeois culture. And this was to be a fierce struggle, a class struggle for the new. One aspect of this cultural revolution is what is called social purging. This meant various public trials against people known as bourgeois experts. This mainly meant engineers, not from a working class background. And this started in 1928 when many engineers were accused of sabotage against the Soviet state. They were arrested, they were tried very briefly, they were imprisoned, and they were often sent to the camps. Even more important, communists everywhere in every part of society were encouraged to challenge the role of what were called non-proletarian experts, no matter where they worked. And here, proletarian meant not just of working class background, but also not holding to proletarian ideology. This struggle took place everywhere, in almost every profession and institution, schools and factories, even orchestras. In part, this cultural revolution, this social purging, this fight against members of the old classes or old ideologies was directed from above, very much directed from above. And yet it's clear that some of this took place, increasing amounts of it took place spontaneously, that local people, individuals, found this movement to be appealing for their own reasons, exciting even. For example, students at universities felt they had good reasons, positive reasons of their own, to attack non-party professors. They would hiss at non-communist lecturers during their courses. They would call them names, bourgeois, typically. They would shout out criticism. They would, in many schools, insisted that all professors had to stand for re-election so that only communist professors could be elected. And in fact, many existing professors in universities were replaced by young communists.